the approach that's being talked about is so fundamentally wrong that it's better to reassess the situation. So I think it's just as well that we not have a substantive treaty, because if it's going to be the Kyoto type thing and people agree to that, then they'll spend years trying to determine exactly what that means and what is the commitment, what are the mechanisms, and these, the whole idea that you have goals which you're supposed to try to meet and that you have outs with offsets means that it's an attempt to continue business as usual. And as I mentioned in the book, this is analogous to the indulgences that the Catholic Church sold in the Middle Ages, which is an excellent solution for both the church. The bishops collected lots of money, and the sinners got redemption so they could still go to heaven. So it's both parties liked that arrangement.
Suzanne Goldenberg's our U.S. environment correspondent. She's in our Washington office. Suzanne, what do you make of James Hansen hoping that Copenhagen fails?
Well, Hansen's argument would be that the process is so fatally flawed because it relies on cap and trade that it'd be better to have nothing at all. But I think this is an area where the climate scientist is really, going against the flow. This sets him apart from just about everybody else in the environmental community, which supports cap and trade. And he recognizes this, but he still thinks there's, a tiny crack in the door to promote his policy, which it would be just to put a tax on the price of carbon right at the mine or at the port.
He was also asked about the leaked emails at the Climate Research Centre at the University of East Anglia.
It has no impact on our understanding of the climate system. It's a public relations matter, and it's very bad public relations for the science.
But was there an attempt there to censor, do you think?
I think there were two fundamental mistakes revealed by that. The one is you have to make your data, your input data, available to the community. You can't say it's not available. I mean, that's the way with science, you have to allow other people to try to duplicate your analysis. That's just very fundamental. And so that was one mistake. But the other one is the trying to prevent contrarians from making their viewpoint. And, I mean, you can say, well, it's shoddy science, so the peer review process should prevent them from publishing. But you can eventually, if you submit a paper enough places, you can eventually publish it, even if it's got some, it's somewhat shoddy. And the fact that Al Gore in his movie says, oh, there are 930 papers that agree on human-made and zero, that's just not realistic in any scientific issue. There are going to be some people who have contrary opinions. And you shouldn't try to prevent that, I don't think. I think that was a mistake.
Phil Jones, the unit's head, has stepped down while an inquiry is carried out. Suzanne, have these leaked emails caused much of a stir in the US?
Absolutely. There was a hearing in Congress on Wednesday in which John Holdren, who's President Obama's science advisor and who appears in these emails, has been called to account for that. He was called to be part of by one of the leading Republicans, called him someone who is a science fascist, science McCarthyite. Holdren appears in the emails criticizing some of the contrarians on climate science, and he says they don't know what they're talking about. But he insists that the emails, although extremely embarrassing, doesn't alter the main fact that the bulk of the science is sound and has been shown to be sound repeatedly.
Also in the UK, Labour says that nuclear power should be an important part of meeting our future energy needs, whereas the Conservatives have said they won't build any more nuclear power stations. James Hansen backs a nuclear option.
I'm disappointed that the Democratic Party is not able to rise above the minority of anti-nukes. I think that they, even if there's any uncertainty in the minds of politicians about whether nuclear power should play a role, it should not have stopped the R&D, because the world is not going to give up nuclear power. And if the United States is going to play a positive role, it needs to be in a position to influence the international agreements that try to limit the possibility of nuclear power being used for weapons purposes, for example. And so we still have, although I think China is going to pass us very soon, we still have the best expertise in nuclear power, and especially at Argonne National Laboratory. And the guys are getting old there. So it's really a terrible shame that in 1994 Clinton terminated that R&D, because we could have had functioning fourth-generation nuclear power now. And even if you only use it to burn the nuclear waste, you shouldn't have terminated that research. But it was the caving in to this small, very vocal anti-nuclear segment. You know, it was people who grew up in the 1970 era at the time of the Three Mile Island thing and Jane Fonda and things. And it was proper to put a stop on any further nuclear development until that was really looked at carefully. But decades later, the situation is very different, has become very different.
Suzanne, is that a mainstream view in the U.S.?
I think that there is, considerable and growing support here for the use and expansion of nuclear power. Now, let's step back a bit. There haven't been any new nuclear plants built in the U.S. in a generation. And the process is extremely slow. It takes years and years to get approvals. But Hansen and the Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, and prominent people in Congress are now saying, look, you have to sort of stop this virtual moratorium on nuclear power. And we have to recognize that nuclear power will be part of the mix. I mean, James Hansen and others are careful to point out that you have to increase energy efficiency. You certainly have to spread the use of wind power and solar power. But you can't rule out the use of nuclear power. That's going to have to be part of the solution.